Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Today, John Hendrickson joins us. John's a senior outreach specialist for the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems at UW-Madison. He directs the 2009 Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers, helping you get started in small-scale vegetable production and marketing, if you want to do that. It's a three-day school. It's held Friday through Sunday, January 15th, 16th, and 17th on the UW-Madison campus. So we're pleased to have him here to talk about that school and also talk with you about how to get more produce or more food from your own household garden. So questions, comments, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org. John, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
So we've got, what is this, the 12th year?
We've been running this since 1998, so we've got a few growth rings on the tree, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. And tell us more. Tell us about who's it for.
Well, this is a class for people who are serious about making that step to starting a small business, growing and marketing fresh produce. We've got a great program. We've got three experienced instructors who do the lion's share of the teaching, as well as some fabulous faculty and staff from here on campus that come in and give some targeted presentations. And you know, this is the place to be if you've got a passion for doing this and want to make it more than just a weekend or a weekend hobby.
Well, and anyone can.
Yes, this is open to anyone. We actually usually attract people from out of state. In fact, for this. So we call it the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers, but people from across the border are welcome to attend, too.
Yeah. And you have quite a bit of experience yourself. I mean, you've got your own little business going.
I do. I work part-time for the University of Wisconsin and work sometimes more than part-time, more than full-time on my own small farm. It demands a lot of work, but it's something I enjoy doing. We have a small farm. We sell mostly to restaurants.
Now, what vegetables do you grow?
Well, unlike a lot of growers that try to grow a little bit of everything, I've decided that I can't manage all of that, so I've been trying to grow fewer things each year. My largest crop is garlic, and I also grow a lot of peppers, a lot of root crops, especially carrots. I do a lot of the alliums in addition to garlic, onions, scallions, leeks, shallots. Winter squash is another big crop.
So you still grow quite a few.
It's hard. You know, you look at the seed catalog and it's hard to say no.
We were just talking about this the other day on the program, and one of the experts said, you know, it's probably a good idea to specialize a little bit more. Most people get started with a big range of vegetables, and sometimes it's better to sort of become an expert in fewer than a generalist in many.
Well, I think it in part has to do with the kind of person that you are, whether you how well you can manage chaos.
What's been your experience selling to restaurants?
Well, it fits really well with my my farm, particularly the scale of my farm, which is quite small. So I'm able to pay really close attention to detail, produce a really high quality and box up a really high quality product, which is what a lot of the chefs are looking for. They want to be wowed when they open up the box and see how fresh and clean and well cared for the produce is. So that fits in well with my small farm. One of the reasons why I started to farm is because I like to be on the farm. I don't like to be off the farm so much. And if you sell at a farmer's market or do some other types of marketing, you can be away from the farm for
a lot.
A lot of the time. You know, if it's market day, that's usually takes up most of your day. And if you do more than one market, that may be 2 or 3 days when you're off the farm. I like to receive orders from restaurants, pick for those orders, and then do my deliveries quick, so I can spend most of my time on the farm.
Do you do any delivery in wintertime?
I do, and that's actually one of the things that I was hoping to touch on today in terms of helping people get the most out of their home gardens or commercial gardens is the opportunity to sell things through the wintertime. I delivered some shallots just this week.
All right.
And there's certainly many other crops that you could be delivering right now, carrots, onions, garlic, cabbage.
Why not?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, let's take some calls. Again, if you'd like to join in, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us as well at talk@WPR.org. Let's turn to Chris in Two Rivers. Chris, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I am interested in starting a pick-your-own strawberry mini farm type of thing. I started out with a garden about 100 feet by 100 feet, and I planted all those strawberries last year. I got a soil sample done, so I know what the fertilizer is. What other information could you tell me to run this successfully?
Well, I'm not a strawberry expert. I mainly stick with vegetables, but, of course, one of the main things with a U-pick operation is location, given that you're going to be having people come out to your farm. Now, the advantage with something like strawberries, which has, you know, people really like and sometimes are willing to drive a little bit further for than, say, a U-pick rutabaga or something like that.
Yeah.
But certainly location is important. The other thing that I would say about a U-pick operation is that you have to be the kind of person that really wants to deal with customers and wants to deal with them all day long and all week long during the strawberry season. You know, you won't have any private time during that, so you need to think about opening up your home, essentially. To people, you need to think about parking and all the organizational issues of getting people out to the field and making sure they're picking in the right locations based on where you've harvested the previous day, the previous morning, et cetera.
Yeah, that's why I started out small, because I thought I could accommodate that real well. I've been in business for 35 years with a different type of business, and I want to semi-retire from that, and this would be my hobby.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any problem with... I want to grow raspberries also, but I understand that blackberries shouldn't be planted anywhere near raspberries.
I cannot answer that question, not being a berry expert, so we'll have to defer that to one of Larry's guests that could answer questions about the bramble crops.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. All right, somebody else might join in and have a response to that as well as we go along here today. Let's turn to Brent in La Crosse. Next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hey, John. I was wondering if you're going to offer the cut flower class this year.
Ah, somebody who knows me a little bit.
I think I had the O2 class.
Okay, yep. Oh, it's great to hear from a graduate. We are offering the cut flower school again this year. I was going to mention that later in the show. The flower school we ran 3 years consecutively. We took last year off, but we're bringing it back. It's going to be March 13th and 14th, and the registration form can be found online. If you search for 2010 Cut Flower School, maybe put the Wisconsin abbreviation on there to make sure that you hone in on our program, and you'll be able to find the registration form on our website.
All right.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call as well. Let's talk about some of the topics. And again, you can join us, by the way, with your questions or comments as we move along here at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org. We'd love to hear from you as we talk with John today. The topics we should just get this out of the way, too. You talk about soil fertility, plant health.
In terms of the topics at the school, at the grower school, yes, we have 3 days. We pack a lot into those 3 days. We try to cover really everything that you're going to need to. And, of course, farmers have to be jacks of all trades. They have to be able to construct things and repair things and grow things and sell things and manage the books and all that. So we try to touch on all of that. We cover everything from soils through crop production, the greenhouse, season extension, irrigation, labor needs, the equipment you're going to need to invest in, the economics, how much you can expect to earn growing and selling vegetables, the whole thing.
Have you been looking at all at the garden catalogs this spring?
You bet. although since I'm organizing this school, I haven't been able to spend as much time with those as I would have liked. I had a little bit of time over the holidays to start looking at the, and you just drool over the catalogs.
The catalogs, is there anything new that's striking your fancy or that you noticed in vegetables?
Well, You know, one of the things that, and this isn't altogether new this year, but, you know, they've been increasing number of offerings in the carrot department in terms of other colors of carrots. Most people just expect carrots to be orange, but there are white carrots and yellow carrots and red carrots and purple carrots. And I've been resisting growing those because, quite frankly, none of those colored carrots has the flavor and sweetness of an orange carrot because we've been growing orange carrots for so long and the breeders have been working on those for so long that we've really got some excellent carrot varieties. And so I've been resisting the colored carrots, but I have customers asking for them. And of course, you know, the customer
is right. is always right.
So I'm going to be looking into growing some of those carrot varieties this year, those colored carrot varieties.
Well, if nothing else, they'll make a great addition to the plate, you know, and another color.
Right. And, you know, that's something that, that I find really helps with sales, whether it be at a farmer's market or to restaurants, to be able to have things in different colors and even to sell them, you know, as mixed batches or mixed bunches can be really effective way to sell things. I remember one year I'm not growing too much eggplant anymore, but I was having a hard time selling my eggplant, and I had purple eggplant and white eggplant and some of the purple white striped eggplants.
Yeah.
And I was trying to sell them and they wouldn't sell. And then I offered them to the restaurants as a mixed box and immediately they started selling.
So there you have it. Jared in River Falls. Let's turn to you now. Hi, Jared. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I have a quick question for you. I'd like to grow some root vegetables in my basement during the winter. Would that be cost-effective with electricity and, like, a hydroponic system?
To actually grow them from seed to harvest in the basement?
Probably grow them from seeds during the late summer, early fall, and then transfer them to the basement so they keep growing.
Well, usually what's done with root crops is you just grow them all the way to maturity and then harvest them, and then you can keep root crops in a root cellar for all winter long, if you've got the right conditions. So I can't imagine it would be cost effective to move them and keep them growing, but you could certainly would be effective to harvest them and then store them for use during the wintertime.
And so put some energy into a good storage facility for them.
Exactly. Yeah. And most of those root crops want to be kept cold and humid in storage. It's one of the reasons why traditionally a lot of root cellars involved packing things in wet sand. So I'm sure some of our readers have done that or remember their parents or grandparents doing that.
So when you're talking cold, what kinds of temperatures are you talking about?
Most of the root crops really store the best just above freezing. That depends. Beets need to be kept a little bit warmer, but something like carrots need to be around 32, 33 to store effectively.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. So that's the way I'd kind of look at it. You can dig yourself to put a root cellar in. You know, the basements are just too warm anymore.
Yeah. A modern constructed house, the basements might be too warm. But, you know, if you have a corner of a basement or a small room in a basement that you, especially one that might have one of those little windows, the low windows that are up above right at the soil level.
Yeah.
You could put a vent in there that could,
if
you hook up the vent to a thermostat, you could allow cold air in until you achieve the temperature that you wanted, and then have that close in order to keep it from getting too cold. So there are ways to, even in a new house, but, you know, I live in an old farmhouse, so my basement's
no problem
plenty
there.
Cold.
John Hendrickson, our guest today, as we talk with him about, well, we've been talking a lot about the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers, maybe help you get started in small-scale vegetable production and marketing. But we can also talk about how you can produce more food for your own home garden. If you're interested in that, I hope you'll join in as well. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about the vegetable garden today on this edition of Garden Talk with John Hendrickson. I hope you have some questions for us. Please join in. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. John, I want to go back to a comment you made a little earlier. You said you were delivering, was it leeks?
Shallots.
Shallots.
I delivered this week, yeah.
And the question I probably should have asked at that time is, how do you do that? I mean, what kind of setup do you have for the ability to be able to harvest and actually have those vegetables?
Well, you know, all the things that I'm selling now were harvested a long time ago.
Okay.
The shallots, you know, in July, August, were pulled out of the ground, cured in the field. In order for onions and shallots to store for a long time, you need that neck to dry down and get as tight as possible to prevent disease organisms from entering. And in the case of shallots actually store better and longer than onions.
Is that right?
Yeah, they store incredibly long time. Particularly I found the yellow shallots. There are red shallots and gray shallots. I've had the best luck with yellow shallots. So I have actually at this point relatively crude rudimentary storage facilities on my farm.
Yeah.
But this is something that I look at as a real opportunity for my operation. You know, there's a lot of people that are, and particularly a lot of market growers that are looking to extend their growing seasons. And I try to do some of that as well, plant early and protect crops to have them as late as I can. But, you know, as short as the Wisconsin growing season is, I'm often kind of ready for it to end when the time comes. I'm a little tired and weary from really long days in the field. So rather than extend the growing season, I've been looking to extend my marketing season,
okay.
Which is why I'm interested in growing the storage crops to sell during the wintertime. Now, obviously, there are pros and cons to doing that, too. While I'm not out in the field, I do need to have storage facilities.
Yeah.
A lot of the crops like carrots store best if they're not cleaned.
Mm-hmm.
When they're put into storage, and so you need to have a way to clean them in the middle of wintertime, and
yeah.
You know, that's a little bit tricky. But you can have carrots and shallots and onions and garlic and potatoes and sweet potatoes and lots of different crops to sell, through December, January, if not February, March, and you know, all the way up until you have the first crops coming in the spring from your farm.
Let's go to Jenny in Lake Mills next. Jenny, hi to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi, it's Jeannie, but that's okay. I think I missed a little bit when I was calling in. I just read Elliot Coleman's book last weekend about extending the growing season basically through the whole winter except end of December and January, where he is in Maine. And I'm thinking that would be a really neat thing to at least make an attempt at here, but it sounds like you already covered that, so I'll skip that and go on to my other question.
Well, actually, we can still talk about that too.
Yeah, we didn't really touch on that, and there's tremendous opportunities there with unheated hoop houses or minimally heated hoop houses to have crops all the way through the wintertime. There are people doing that in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan. You mentioned Elliot Coleman in Maine. The thing to remember about Elliot Coleman in Maine is that while he is in Maine, if you look at the growing zones, because he's near the coast, he actually has a bit warmer, better climate for doing winter production than we do in Wisconsin. So he has things a little bit easier than we do. It also really helps to be in a sunnier location. We sometimes deal with some long stretches of gray days in Wisconsin, which can impact the people that are trying to produce things through the winter, but there's a host of greens, spinach, many other crops that you can keep going in the hoop house. They don't do a lot of growing, and so you've got to start them early enough so they put on a lot of growth before it gets cold and dark. But it's almost like a storage facility. Instead of harvesting things and putting them in a cooler or a bin in a root cellar, you're keeping them in the ground in the hoop house and harvesting. And then on the sunny days that we have during the wintertime, they can do some regrowth.
Hmm. Yes, it sounded like one of the most important part didn't turn out to be so much the heat as the hours of sunlight. And it, he said he found that if it was under 10 hours, then forget it. As long as he had 10 hours or more, he was able to keep things, you know, they might be dormant for a while, but they would keep going at least and not freeze and die off. So it was a really interesting book.
Yep, that's exactly right. It's really the day length and sun more than the temperature. And of course, what we're dealing with here is the cold, hardy crops.
Mm-hmm. They do a lot of lettuces and things.
Yep.
My other question was the last two. I'm just finally getting back to gardening the last couple of years, and my gardens are surrounded by fields that the farmer rents from us, and he uses all the chemicals and stuff, and I'm trying to avoid the chemicals. But the last 2 years, I had these little green beetles that attacked everything. They started in the squash, but they weren't striped like the pictures I see of the cucumber beetles, and they went after everything. They were in my sunflowers. They were in the squash. They attacked the beans, but they didn't hurt the beans. They just ate the foliage, I think. And I cannot find what those could possibly be or what to do about them. But related again to Elliot Coleman's book, he was mentioning how a lot of the things we do to take care of the bugs actually can make things worse. And I'm wondering if the fact that my garden is so close to these fields that are, you know, where they're fertilized and all the extra sprays and stuff they do for weed killers and bugs, if that could be actually detrimental to my own garden and keeping things out of it.
Okay. What do you think, John?
Well, that certainly can have an impact. Those little green guys, and they look an awful lot like a striped cucumber beetle or a spotted cucumber beetle, except they're all green. Those are the adult form, and I wish Phil Pelletieri was with us to absolutely confirm this because I'm not an entomologist, but I believe those are the adult form of the corn root worm.
Yes.
Ah.
And so, you know, you said you're surrounded by conventional farm fields. My guess is that's corn a lot of the years that you're doing your garden. And those are nonspecific insects in terms of the things that they like to eat. And I have those in my fields as well. It's a tricky one to deal with. You know, they like the corn silks. If it's not corn silks, they'll certainly come over and dine on your vegetable crops as well.
Well, I do have another area that I might be able to, if I can figure out how to get water to it, I might be able to use it. It's quite a ways and separated by a tree line. So I'm hoping to try a spot up in that area this year to see if that helps.
Yeah, with a lot of the crops, you can use row cover to exclude that type of insect pest.
Mm-hmm.
If you're familiar with the spun polyester
right.
row covers. So that's
mm-hmm.
that's one of the best solutions that I know of.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Jim in Green Bay next. Jim, hello.
Good morning. Say, I was going to give your listeners an idea. You can use your window wells for either storage or growing cold season crops. And it works really nice.
That's a good idea. Have you done that, John, or know about that?
I've heard of people doing that. Why don't you tell us about your setup?
Well, what I do normally is I you know, those plastic hoods that you buy in a store to cover your window wells?
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? Well, in the fall time, I prepare my window wells. Okay, like I'll put a little lettuce in one window well, and then I'll put spinach in another window well. And I have everything ready inside the window well on the ground part, and then I seal off as much as I can of the window well. Then I go down the basement. I open up, which I have it. I have mine removed, you know. But I mean, I can put them back, put the windows back in. But I have it removed, and I can just work from the inside, and I can monitor everything from the inside. I don't have to go out in the cold.
And there's enough warmth in the basement.
Well, you open up, crack that little window open.
Yeah.
And you put up like one of these, I had these from the refrigerator thermostats or fish aquarium, even those things. You stick up against put one up against the outside wall that I can look at. And I keep it about 45, 40, somewhere in there. And it seems to hold everything. And with your potatoes and that, I just take newspapers, soak, wet them down, and just lay them on the floor of the outside there.
Yeah.
And you can pack them that way. You have to experiment with what works for you. You know what I mean? You can fill them, you can fill it up with sand if you want, but it you can store. You can store meat out there if you have a cold winter. And this sounds going to help my family is listening to me. But I've got meat out in the snow right now. You know what I mean? And it's just fun if you just keep experimenting. You know, like if you have a big leaf pile in the fall time, well, heck, you can make a root cellar out of that darn thing. Just dig down where the leaves are dry. Mm-hmm. And bury whatever you have to, and just keep track of where you buried everything. Put them in boxes, or that some with air can circulate, and it works.
And it
sure,
works.
you'd have to be concerned about rodents and getting into things. But
if you take some of this, if you got wiring like a screen,
hardware cloth,
you put that. You're gonna have some damage done. I mean, I don't think you're gonna be able to get away from it completely. But it's really cool. I'm out there. People think I'm crazy. I'm out there digging in the snow right now. I got a big pile out there. And I'll be, when I get the acre and have something, I'll go out and get some carrots.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Jim?
I'm a survivalist.
Right. That's a great idea.
Those are good ideas. I thought he was going to talk about using the window wells like a cold frame and actually grow crops in them. But it sounded like he was primarily using those for storage.
For storage, yeah. Thanks again, Jim. Appreciate it very much. Oh, there's all kinds of ways to do it. Luba in Madison, let's turn to you now. Hi.
Hi there. I have a question about how to approach escarole or endive that prickly lettuce. And I've grown some, and I haven't really been terribly happy with it. And how can I find out the various companies that particularly have that vegetable in mind?
In terms of buying the seed?
Yes.
I often revert or return to Johnny's Selected Seeds. They are a very well-respected company. They've been around for a really long time. They're located in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
I know they have a number of varieties of those. I have to be honest, I have no experience trying to grow those.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not speaking from any basis of experience.
Right.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Somebody else might have some comments on that as well. Let's go to Sam in Milwaukee next. Hi, Sam. Thank you for calling.
Hey, guys. Thanks for doing the show.
Sure.
Hey, question for you. I did a little bit of gardening last year, and I liked it so much. I'm really interested in trying to do a little market gardening this summer.
Okay.
Great.
And my family's got a little bit of land, and we've been renting it out to the neighboring farmer for years, and it seems like he's been doing corn on it every year for about 20 years.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I want to have a pretty big garden, but I'm worried if I put all this money into seeds and equipment and the soil's not too great, well, the crops aren't going to do very well. So I was thinking maybe it'd be better to have a really small garden this year and just work on composting and cover crops to get the soil up. Does that seem like the thing to do, or can I kind of try to go for it?
You are right on track in terms of starting small and getting used to the land, working in compost, getting some cover crops growing so you can improve that soil. That is absolutely the best way to go. And too often, too many people don't do that, and they jump in and they get in maybe a little bit over their head, or they just don't get good results because they haven't worked on the soil part first.
Thanks. And also, are there any crops in particular or vegetable crops that would be more suited to kind of this corn land?
What you need to do, I think, first is a good step would be to get some soil testing done.
Right.
Because that is, and if you explain what you want to do with the soil or with the ground, you can get some recommendations.
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken.
That's right. If you send in your soil sample to the UW lab and you indicate what kind of crops you're going to be growing in the future, you can specify a vegetable crop, or what a lot of market growers do is there's a category for in the soil test form for truck crops, which is kind of an old-fashioned term for vegetable growing when it's reference to people trucking their fresh produce into the city every day, every week. So you can check that truck crops category, and you'll get recommendations specific from the lab to your situation. And, you know, the other thing to do along the same lines is to contact your local extension agent, find out what kind of soil you have. There are soil maps, so you can find out exactly what kind of soil you have and get some recommendations.
All right.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, with your questions. We're talking about producing vegetables here for market or in your own home garden. Our guest, John Hendrickson, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Email from Brett in Grand Rapids, Michigan, who's listening online. He said, last year my grandpa planted potatoes late in the season in order to produce seed potatoes for this spring. The plants didn't do so well. I was told they were affected by blight. However, they did produce quite a large amount of potatoes, which we harvested. The potatoes look fine and don't appear diseased, but I'm concerned they may have pathogens left over from last year's blight. Should we go ahead and plant these potatoes next spring?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, the potato famine was a result of people replanting potatoes over and over again and having those be diseased. You know, we had a terrible late blight situation here, across New England, New York, and here in the Midwest. So I wouldn't be surprised if your potatoes were contaminated. Potatoes, unfortunately, are prone to a host of pathogens. Commercial potatoes are actually sprayed quite regularly through the growing season because of all the disease issues with potatoes. And seed potatoes are grown on farms where there is a certification process to ensure that they are clean. And that's why a lot of growers, myself included, I do not replant my potatoes. I try to sell or eat all of my potatoes, and then I buy new seed each year.
And Jason in Green Bay says, I live in Green Bay and have a 16 by 16 salsa garden. Gets about 9 hours of sunlight a day. Each year I have a bumper crop of tomatoes and peppers, but I can't grow onions to save my life. I plant them as bulbs, and they look great for about 3 or 4 weeks, right up until the time that the stalks collapse under their own weight. At harvest time, the bulbs are only a hair larger than the bulbs I planted a few months earlier. What's the trick to growing quality onions?
That's a really good question. Well, it sounds like you're planting onion sets, the little tiny bulbs that you can buy at the garden center or the hardware store or what have you. In my experience, the best onions I've ever grown have been a result of planting from seed and not planting those onion sets. Part of it is just the system involved in producing those onion sets. An onion is biennial. Those onions are grown in the south and then pulled from the ground and put into storage so that they'll stop their growing process and then start again the next year. And so they just, my experience, they just don't grow as well or as large as an onion that's grown from seed or from plant. You can buy onion plants from a number of seed companies in addition to onion seed if you don't have a greenhouse or a basement where you can grow things under lights. You can order the plant. So I would encourage you to try that. Also, there are different types of onions. There's long-day onions and short-day onions. And you should, you said you had 9 hours of...
9 hours,
and,
yeah.
So it's important to get the onions started early in the year. And I typically grow a long-day onion, start it from seed, get it started. It gets transplanted out as early as possible because it really requires a significant amount of growing time to produce a good-sized onion.
And Rebecca says, I'm wondering if it's still possible to register for your school. The website says that the deadline was the 4th of January, but I'd really like to go. I missed the first part of the show, so I didn't hear whether it's still possible to sign up.
Well, you know, if it hadn't been possible, I probably wouldn't have brought it up with the audience. So, yes, we do still have room. We you know, we like to put the deadline down so that we hopefully get most of the people signed up in advance and all that. But we do still have room. So if she's interested, she can contact me or find the registration form online. And I don't can't remember if you'd given my contact information yet.
No, I did not give that yet. So go ahead.
Sure. My phone number is 608-265-3704.
265-3704. Okay, and online, where would they go?
Well, I work at the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems. Our website can be found using those as search terms, or if you just want to search for the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers, it'll pop up in most search engines.
Let's go to Sandy in Algoma next. Sandy, hello.
Hi. You know what? I was just the one caller that was concerned because of the beetles that kind of took over her garden. I was going to let her know that we have guinea hens, and what I do is I encourage my guinea hens to go in my garden, and they hunt down all the insects that are in there, and they'll eat everything. They don't touch the plants. They really don't bother any of my vegetables, and we love these birds. They're wonderful. Another thing that she could do is make up natural soap sprays that, you know, they use tobacco juice, chili pepper, Tabasco sauce, this kind of stuff. And she can find those at, like, an organic gardening books. I've never used chemicals in my garden ever. And I don't really have a big problem with pests. One other thing that I was going to ask was I set up a hoop house last spring. And I made it out of PVC, which was probably a mistake, but that was kind of the plans that I had. And unfortunately, when we got this last big snow, it's now flattened.
Oh.
So, but I was wondering, I'm having difficulty finding, like, the metal hoops to build a new house. I wonder if your guest has any ideas where I could possibly get some of those from.
You know, I've got to tell you one story. About a friend of mine, and this friend of mine went to a place that sells boat hoists, and he got the top half of a boat hoist for little or not. It was an old one, and it wasn't going to be reused, and he made a hoop house out of you know what a boat hoist looks like.
I really don't.
Well, how to describe it?
Well, I guess I would describe it as the metal frame for an awning almost, because some boat hoists do have are covered with canvas so that the boat can be protected while it's in the hoist over winter. Is that not true?
Are they like half circles?
There are sort of aluminum poles that go up the side. Okay, and they might go up, I don't know how many feet. You can have it as high as you want it, frankly. And then there are other metal...
arches?
Arches that go between. And they're really sturdy.
Okay.
They've got to be able to hold a boat, right?
They've got to be able to... Yeah, they need to protect the boat. And the bottom half, obviously, you don't want or need. That's the part that lifts the boat out of the water, and it lifts it up underneath this canopy, and that person then took I don't know, some sort of plastic, clear plastic or whatever, and made a really nice one, and it is sturdy.
Wow.
Yep, you can certainly do some scrounging like that. I used to live near Beaver Dam Lake, and I remember actually looking at the boat hoist, thinking that exact same thing. I never fell into a situation where I was able to acquire one. To answer your question about hoops, yeah, the PVC is sometimes an attractive option because it's readily available and easy to cut and easy to bend and all of that, but generally not recommended because it's not very sturdy unless you put in some additional supports before the snows come. You can use electrical conduit piping.
Okay.
And either get creative, and there are various ways that people have devised to bend arches, to bend those pieces. You can actually buy it's brand new in the Johnny's Selected Seeds catalog, which I mentioned before as a good source for seed. They have a a tool to help you bend pipe in their catalog this year. You can also buy pipe benders at the hardware store.
Sure.
You can attach it to a tree and bend it, and there's all kinds of different ways that people have devised to bend pipe. There are also certainly a lot of companies that will be happy to sell you bows for a hoop house. Probably the easiest one and most recognizable on in terms of an online presence is a company called Farm Tech, Farm, and then T-E-K, Farm Tech.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. John Hendrickson, our guest today, Senior Outreach Specialist with the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems, talking about the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers and also, of course, talking about producing more vegetables in your garden. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here on this edition of Garden Talk, talking about the vegetable garden and marketing vegetables as well with John Hendrickson. Pleased to have him along. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Bob in Iola next. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. This is really good stuff. Thanks much.
You bet.
Hey, we've had an organic garden here. We've been running it about 25 years. Bug problems once in a while. My question is specifically, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot here, but I just came across a chemical that somebody else had called Weed Be Gone. And the basic ingredient in it is arsenic. And I was just astounded that a chemical like this could still have an EPA registration number. Once you put that on the soil, it's there forever, and that area is contaminated. Can you comment on that?
Boy, I am not, unfortunately, not in a position to comment on that. I would, if you're really concerned about that and want to follow up, there's an excellent weed management specialist in the Department of Horticulture here, Jed Calhoun. I'm going to not be able to spell Jed's last name. It's not spelled with a normal Calhoun spelling. But if you go to the Department of Horticulture website, you should be able to find contact information for Jed. And he is a weed management specialist, knows a lot about the various approved chemicals to use and the various formulations. So I would defer to him.
Okay. All right, thanks for calling, and do follow up. That's something we could bring up on another show, as a matter of fact, as I have some of another guest or two with who may have that sort of background. We'll certainly bring it up. Joan in Green Bay, we are on to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, what a wonderful program. We've dug up a spot in the lawn where I've planted two tomato plants. I know my grandfather used to rotate crops. I was getting tomatoes as large as a softball, and last year they just weren't that big. Can I plant them in the same location every year, or is there some kind of fertilizers I could use that planting them in the same location? And what about horse manure?
Okay, well, you can get away with planting crops in the same locations. If you're going to do that, if you just have a limited amount of space, maybe your yard doesn't get enough sun, so you can't move things around, I would encourage you to build a raised bed and amend that raised bed with compost. You can buy various manure composts from garden centers and hardware stores. So that you can replenish the nutrients in the soil. I'd also encourage you to mulch your tomatoes. A lot of the diseases that tomatoes get are a result of they're in the soil and they get onto the leaves from splash when it rains. So you might have better luck if you work on amending your soil and if you use mulch. Of course, the ideal is to rotate crops and not have crops grown in the same location. It's nice to have a 3 to 5 year span of time in between growing the crops in the same location.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And then kind of cleaning that area out every year is going to, get rid of all
yeah,
of the
get
old...
rid of the old plant residue, yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good point, Larry.
We have some open lines. You can get on pretty quickly here with your question at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Tom in South Beloit. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, good morning. I was calling in specifically to address the lady with the hoop house issues.
Yes.
I attended a demonstration or a seminar or something like that, but the basic plan for the thing was you made it out of, 3/8-inch rebar, and it was 20-foot-long pieces of rebar, the stuff you reinforce cement with.
Yes.
That stuff is, you can get it at the big box hardware stores and stuff like that. But when you got these 20-foot rebars, you bent them over like a hoop, and you'd anchor one side in the ground, in a section of pipe, and you'd anchor the other side. It was about 10 or 12 foot wide. You could make it, and. Then you'd run a couple across the top to tie the different loops together, but you'd space the rebars. I think it was about 4 feet apart, but they needed you to make almost a 12 by 40 or 50 foot house with the stuff. And when you put the plastic over it, you got a 100-foot, you got 100-foot length of that greenhouse plastic, but you doubled it over and sealed it together, and then you inflated it. And when the stuff was inflated, it had insulating properties to it. But I think if she looks around for more plans for hoop houses, she can probably come across them with rebar, and the stuff is a lot stronger. She shouldn't have the problem with the stuff collapsing like she did.
Yeah, those are good points, John.
Yeah, I have seen and heard of people building with rebar. It's not going to be as good or as strong as some tubular metal piping, but it's certainly an option. With rebar, I really would want to put in the cross pieces. They're referred to as purlins in greenhouse, hoop house construction terminology. That'll hold those together so they don't shift around. The one thing that does happen with a lot of different hoop materials is where the metal or the PVC comes in contact with the plastic, you get degradation of the plastic. And rebar being rough with the wind, you might have more abrasion there and run into some problems. So, people have been building hoop houses out of anything they can find. I mean, I've seen ones that utilize tree limbs and cattle fencing, what are referred to as cattle panels, bent mm-hmm. over. There's any number of ways to get the job done. Typically, the more you spend, the less issues you're going to have with maintenance and collapses. The less you spend, you might have more issues with with the snow load. He brought up a really good point about the spacing of the hoops. In Wisconsin, with the snow that we typically get, 4 feet is what's recommended in terms of the spacing in between hoops. In more southern locations down in the south, they typically will have 5 feet in between hoops because they don't have the snow load issue.
Thanks again, Tom. Appreciate your call. Grace emailed us from Elkhorn. This time of the year, like many people, I dream of my vegetable garden, and every year I start with gusto but have a terrible time with weeds. Got a 50 by 50 foot garden. I just can't keep up with the weeds, and it gets depressing. Now, while I'm looking at the seed catalogs, I know I should not get carried away. What do you recommend for weed control? We live in the country and have a mini farm with access to lots of straw. I find it works a little well, but by the middle of summer, it makes no difference. I've never used chemicals, but I'm ready to bite the bullet.
Well, I've often said that one of the keys to being a successful gardener or even a commercial vegetable grower is that you have to like weeding. You really do. There's really kind of no way around that. And while insect pests kind of get a lot of the attention in terms of pests to deal with in a garden, and especially if you're talking about growing organically, it's really the weeds that year in and year out are really the biggest issue for most people. I'll never forget when I first started gardening on some land that my landlord let me use. He also had a garden. This was some land kind of back behind some buildings and at the side of a field. And my garden was kind of right next to his garden. And, you know, invariably in the middle of the summer, he'd come back out while I was working and he'd look at mine and he'd look at his and he'd say, "How do you do this? How come your garden doesn't have any weeds in it and mine, you know, you can't find the crops?" And, you know, it was because, you know, from the start, I was committed to being out there and being on top of the weeds. And you know, with key with weeds, to get them small and get them often.
Yeah.
You know, when the best time to weed is before you almost see anything, when the things, the weeds are just sprouting, just germinating. That the root is what they call it, the white thread stage. And you run your hoe through and you see all those little white roots and you know that you've solved some headaches down the road. I'm not saying anything that's any really new or the silver bullet, but there's no replacing being out there in a timely manner and being on top of it. Certainly mulch, you can do a lot with mulch. I agree that sometimes that can fall through and not be a solution for the entire season.
And we can talk some more about mulch, and we will, with our guest John Hendrickson. Stay with us. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And for this edition of Garden Talk, we visit with John Hendrickson, Senior Outreach Specialist with the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems at UW-Madison. He directs the 2009 Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers to help you get started and want to get going on some small-scale vegetable production and marketing. So you can do that, too. And certainly there's some open spots yet. We can get you into that program if you want. It's January 15th, 16th, and 17th on the UW-Madison campus. In the meantime, we have many callers online with questions. But before we go back to the phones, let's talk some more about weeds and mulching. You know, someone emailed in that gets really frustrated with the amount of weeding that goes on. Mulching can help a lot. I always saved my when I had a big vegetable garden, I saved my leaves, tree leaves from the fall, put them in plastic bags and used those as mulch in the spring. And of course, as they broke down, you know, they went into the soil too to amend the soil.
And leaves are a great thing to amend your soil. So that's the nice thing about mulch is that you're getting more than one benefit from doing that. You're avoiding some of the weeding.
Yes.
And you're also amending your soil. You know, and one of my jobs when I grew up, my family had a large vegetable garden, and one of my big jobs growing up was mowing the grass. And my father had me catch the grass, and then we mulched in our garden with the grass clippings. And so
sure.
I carried the grass clippings into the garden and mulched the garden at the same time that I was cutting the grass. Mm-hmm. You know, another thing that the caller or the emailer, I can't remember if it was a phone call or an email, could try is using plastic mulch or landscape fabric. Both of those are available and can be put down. And, you know, it's typically used for crops that you're going to be transplanting into rather than direct seeding. It's not something that you'd use with a crop like spinach or lettuce that
right.
you might be sowing by, or carrots that you might be sowing by seed. But in terms of tomatoes and peppers and eggplants and squash and things like that,
works great.
It works really wonderful. Yep.
Let's go to Chuck in Middleton. Chuck, hello. Thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. Always enjoy your programs.
Thank you.
You mentioned raised bed gardens earlier, and I wanted to mention that I'll be offering black locust lumber and dimensional beams, which I've been working with Forest Products Lab to come up with a use for black locust, which is a natural wood, extremely rot resistant. And people have been using it already for raised bed because there are no chemicals in it. And if they would just care to watch woodforyou.us website, they'll be offered this spring.
So it's wood for you?
Correct. WD, the number 4, U.us.
Okay, WD, the number 4, the word U.
No.
No?
The letter U.
I'm sorry, the letter U. Oh, let's get it right. WD, the number 4, the letter U, dot U.S.?
Correct. Correct. And it's, of course, grows in this part of the state, and I saw and dry it for outdoor decking. But then boards that aren't quite usable for that or the beams, I do mill for raised bed gardens or any outdoor use. And it's wonderful because it's natural and has no chemicals like your commercial treated lumber.
Sounds good to me, Chuck. Thank you.
Thank you. Good day.
Yeah, good day. Appreciate it very much. WD4U.us. There you have it. Lynette and Hubertus, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Lynette.
Hi, good afternoon. I was away from the radio for a little while, so I apologize if you've already discussed this, but I have trouble growing red bell peppers, the real thick-skinned or the real thick, fleshy red bells.
Yes.
My green ones come out absolutely wonderful, and if I let them sit there to ripen, by the time they're almost perfectly red, something, either they get black rot on them or some sort of bug gets at them or another critter. Are you supposed to purchase red bell pepper plants, or are you just supposed to let the green ones turn red?
Okay.
Yeah, I grow a lot of peppers. Actually, this past year, that was the second largest crop in terms of sales this past year on my farm. It's something I really like to grow. I feel like the richest man in the world when my refrigerator is full of colored peppers because they're so wonderful. And, you know, this is, you point out, you know, a lot of people ask, well, why are, you know, red peppers in the grocery store so much more expensive than green ones? Well, she's put the finger on it. It's because there's a lot of loss on the farms that are producing peppers. You know, there's a lot of things that can go wrong while they're ripening, and that's why they cost more. Plus, they're, you know, obviously so much better than a green pepper too, because they're nice and sweet. The thing to keep in mind, or a few things to keep in mind. One is to look for varieties in the seed catalog that have shorter maturity dates, and so you'll have a better luck in Wisconsin with ones that are going to turn red sooner than some of the other ones that may be more better suited to a more southern climate with a longer growing season. So look for that. You need to produce a really nice, healthy, strong transplant and get it started earlier, as early as you can in Wisconsin, and get it transplanted out as early as you can in Wisconsin. That might mean providing some protection in the beginning part of the season from the cool nights with some row cover or other means to protect it from cool nights. But really, a variety selection is probably the key.
So get a short season.
Now, do you purchase green and just let them ripen, or do you specifically purchase red?
I do sell some green peppers. I primarily grow peppers to sell red peppers. So when I'm looking in the seed catalogs, I'm looking for colored peppers. You know, any green pepper is going to eventually turn some color. It's going to turn orange or yellow or red. A green pepper is just an unripe sweet pepper. So it'll eventually turn, but there are certainly varieties that have been bred to more consistently and more quickly turn red, and so that's what you want to look for when you're looking in the seed catalog.
All right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling. On to Sherry in Prairie du Sac. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. I'm interested in putting up a hoop house to extend the season and wondering about the orientation for Wisconsin. Should be north-south, east-west, or some degree in between?
That's a great question. Are you planning to use this primarily in the summertime, or are you primarily going to be using it to produce crops in the wintertime?
Planting in the fall to extend or planting in the summer to fall to extend into the winter growing.
Okay.
Okay. Then you should orient your house east-west, because when the sun is low in the sky, as we all know it is so low in the sky during the Wisconsin winter, you want to be able to take advantage, as much advantage of that as you can. And so you're going to want that house running the long way east-west so that you can take advantage of the low travel of the sun. If you were putting up a greenhouse to grow transplants or are going to be using a hoop house primarily for summertime production, then you might consider orienting it the other way to take advantage of the sun when it's
sure.
higher in the sky.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for calling. And let's have another email here from Rick from Iowa County. Says there are plans for a new vegetable processing facility for Highland, Wisconsin in Iowa County. Going to be several meetings for area growers, and the one that's is certain will be in Dodgeville on February 24th at 6 p.m. There are a couple other meetings will be at different times of the day, but gave some information. I had a phone number here to find out more. It's area code 608-930-2000. So 608-930-2000. The number to call to find out some more. That's kind of exciting news.
Yeah, that is. And actually, I'm. Did he give a name of the facility or the organization that's involved in building the facility, Larry?
No, but Rick is affiliated with the Iowa County Area Economic Development Corporation.
Okay.
So.
I believe I'm familiar, not familiar in terms of being involved in that, but I believe that organization just might have received a grant from the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection, or at least were involved in trying to get a grant, because I reviewed some proposals, and I think I read that one.
So meetings for area growers, the first one, or the one that's scheduled for sure, is February 24th at 6 p.m., and it's near Highland, Wisconsin in Iowa County. And the number to call for more, 608-930-2000. Let's turn to Janet in Leaf River, Illinois. Hi there.
Hi. Hello.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Well, I was going to tell you what I do to some of my plants that I put in the garden as plants. They're already started as far as mulching goes, and I find it works very well. I just take newspapers and you just leave them like you get them out of the box at the store, flat, and then you fold them in half again to a quarter, and then you snip off about 4 inches of the newspaper at the folded point, and then you open it up, and the loose edge of the paper, you cut from that into the center where the hole is. And I usually use 4 sheets or more of newspaper to do this, and I place it around the plant on the ground, and then I put a little soil on top of that to keep it from shifting, and then I water it, because then once it's watered, the paper will not blow away. It will stay right there. And I find that I have very little weeding to do around that those plants when I do it that way. It's really very nice as far as getting rid of the weeds near the plant, so you don't have to worry about hitting them with the hoe and cutting them off. And that works very well for me.
That's a great suggestion. Certainly something that someone can do on a small scale. If you're growing, you know, a quarter acre of pepper plants, I don't think I'd want to cut many that many pieces of newspaper, but for a garden, that's just a fabulous solution. I wonder if you've thought about just covering the newspaper with mulch rather than putting soil on top. If you put some soil on top, there could very well be some weed seeds in that soil, and so you might have some weeds growing on top of the newspaper.
You know, I thought about that when I did this the first time, and I thought, well, you might not be solving any problem at all, but I don't put so much soil on it that the plants have much to grow in. It's just enough to keep it from blowing around. And once you put water on it and you water the soil that's laying on top of it, just make sure you get it at each corner. And I don't really totally cover it with soil. It's just kind of mm-hmm. a keep it in place thing until I water it, and it will not leave. It's just kind of stuck there. And another thing it does, I mean, obviously mulching is to keep the soil more moist. I find that when I dig around in there after my garden's done, I have a lot of worms in that area. They seem to like that.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Janet, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call.
Thank you.
And let's take some more calls here. Lee and Racine, we will turn to you next. Hi, Lee. Thanks for calling.
Question about hydroponic growing, indoors especially, basil, stuff like that. What are the advantages versus using soil?
I don't have experience, either personal experience or research experience, in terms of my work here at the university
okay.
with hydroponics, so I would not be in a position to answer that.
All right. I had one other little thing about
sure.
pine needles or pine boughs for mulch, especially in a decorative garden. I've been using those, and they seem to keep insects down, and I don't know if they're toxic, though. I was wondering if there's any ill effects, if you knew.
Well, certainly not toxicity, but the coniferous plants are acidic, and
right.
so you might have some pH changes over time. And so that would be something that a soil test would either refute or confirm.
It's mainly on a path anyway, where you don't want plants. So.
Yeah, well then, yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, it'll mix in eventually, but I have a real small yard, so. They're real pretty to use if anyone was interested. Do you think they're dangerous from a fire point of view or anything?
No, I wouldn't think so.
No, I didn't think so either. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And some more callers. Let's go to Jason and Nina next. Jason, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question. We raise chickens in our backyard, and I have a couple vegetable gardens. And I was wondering how much of the manure to use and how long should it compost before using it?
Well, the only way to be able to tell you how much to use is for you to have your soil tested. And ideally to have the chicken product tested in terms of its nutrient content if you want to get really specific in terms of how much to use.
Okay.
It's certainly best to compost manure before use in terms of spread of disease, but also chicken manure is very hot and has a lot of nitrogen, and you can actually burn plants if you're putting it on too excessively or in a raw state. So it's certainly best to compost that. There's a lot of resources online about composting in terms of how hot to get your piles and how often to turn them. And rather than go through a long explanation and details here, I'd encourage you to, and I shouldn't say just online, but there's obviously a lot of books in the library, too, about that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. I remember a garden that this is years back. I was renting a house and a farmhouse, and there had been a chicken coop in a chicken yard there, and we decided, they said, yeah, if you want to make a garden out of that area there. So I tell you, I had plants and vegetables like you wouldn't believe there for a year or two from that, obviously, a long compost, since composted and into the soil, the pretty high nitrogen content there.
Yeah, I gardened in a location that had been used near an old hog pen. I had similar results.
Let's turn to Bill in Rock County next. Hi, Bill.
How you guys doing?
Good.
Hey, I'm related to the flooring industry. Years ago, I found that asking a carpet store if I could have used carpet out of the dumpster and lay that down in the garden and plant my rose in the carpet. That eliminates your weeding almost completely. The only place you have to weed pretty much is where the carpet edges are weed up or where you cut a slit in it for your plants to grow up through. And it's nice and warm during the summer when you're kneeling on it. It's soft. I mean, it's just a good thing all the way around. And in the fall, you can roll it up, cut it in strips, roll it up, put it out of the way, and then roll it back out again in the spring. Or if you roll it up in the fall, you know, about 30-inch long, wide pieces, you can take it back to the carpet store, usually throw it back in their dumpster. So, just an idea.
And I know some other people who have done that, too, and it's worked pretty well.
I have heard of that. I also know there's a lot of people that decide not to do that because of the various chemicals that are used in the manufacture of carpets.
Yeah.
And so they don't want that in their garden soil. But I know that there are people that, like this fellow, that have used it and have enjoyed not having to weed.
Yeah, that not having to weed is a really good thing. Here's one from Amy. I'm a home gardener with both raised beds and standard plots. I've heard that turning the soil every year breaks up the soil structure, but have not had very good results when I did not thoroughly turn the beds. I mulch all of my beds with shredded leaves, mostly oak and marsh hay, and also kitchen waste. Based compost. So what's better, digging or not?
Well, that's kind of the age old argument. Certainly, there are different schools of thought on this in terms of disrupting the soil structure and turning it. What it comes down to for me is that I find, especially at trying to grow commercially and sell, it's really impractical for me to not do any tilling of the soil. What most sustainable vegetable growers and sustainable farmers in general are trying to do is to reduce the amount of tillage and reduce the impact of the tillage. One of the things that's probably most destructive of soil structure is the rototiller, which, of course, is what so many people use in a garden, and I use it too. You just have to be able to use the tools that you have judiciously and not use them too much. So, if you're going to rototill your garden every year repeatedly, you will eventually see the deleterious effects of that in terms of the soil aggregates and the soil structure and the soil health. But I personally don't find it very practical to grow vegetable crops without doing some tillage.
Yeah. Let's go to Susan in Bristol. Hello, Susan.
Hello. How are you today?
Good.
I really like this show because I'm going to be expanding my gardening area this year, and I've usually just done a few tomatoes and peppers and such like that. I have more experience than I just haven't been doing it. But anyway, growing cruciferous vegetables, I'm concerned about there's those green worms in there, and I want to do everything as organically as possible. I want to know something about how do you keep those down, like for Brussels sprouts and cauliflower and such. And also, if having praying mantises, ladybugs, and a bat house would help. I heard that you can't have praying mantises and ladybugs at the same time because then they just eat the ladybug.
Now, I don't know the specifics about the praying mantises. Certainly, bats are a great thing to have around if you're a farmer or a gardener because they eat an incredible amount of flying insects through the course of a year. What I would say to you about the cabbage family crops is those green caterpillars. Well, there's a few different of caterpillar pests in the cabbage family. We can just talk about them all generally together. One approach is to use the spun polyester row covers that I mentioned earlier in the show to prevent those. It's these yellow and white butterflies that you see fluttering around your garden that lay the eggs that turn into those caterpillars. So if you can have row covers on your crops to prevent the eggs being laid on them is one step to take. And there also is an organic approved insecticide that can be used on those. It's referred to as BT. BT stands for Bacillus thuringiensis, which is the Latin name for the organism. That is usually it could be put on as a powder or as a liquid. And what happens is those caterpillars ingest the little microorganism, and then it does something to their gut such that they
expire.
Yes, they expire. And it's a really effective biological, naturally occurring organic pest control.
And there you have it. Excuse me. John, thank you so much for being with us today. Again, the Market Growers, Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers, January 15, 16, and 17. For information, you can call 265. What is it?
3704.
265-3704 for more information about getting involved. And thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.